Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 26, verses 1 through 19, the entire chapter, in which we will discuss the laws concerning first fruits and tithes. Our context is this. Moses is giving his last speech, which consists of three discourses. He's in the middle of his second discourse, or at the end of his second discourse, actually talking about the law and how you need to keep the law and what the law is. And so we're still talking about the law, the Mosaic law that he was responsible for receiving at Mount Sinai. And in our last chapter, Deuteronomy 25, he talked about miscellaneous laws, but more specifically talked about Levirate marriage. So now here we are starting in chapter 26, verses 1 through 2. Then it shall be, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, and you possess it and live in it, that you shall take some of the first of all the produce of the ground which you bring in from your land that the Lord your God gives you, and you shall put it in a basket and go to the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name. And of course, that's Jerusalem. Now, as an introduction to this, we need to note that the law of the first fruit ties that ceremony with the land. It's the first fruit of the land, and I'm going to point that out as we go through here. Several indications of this chapter show that the purpose of this ceremony was to remind the Israelites that the land that they were walking on was promised land, a result of the covenant between the patriarchs. And we see that starting out in verse 1. It says, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance, and then the first fruits are enjoined. So we see the connection between this, the ceremony of the first fruits in the land. The land is given as an inheritance. We see that in Exodus 32:13. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven. And all this land of which I have spoken, I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So, of course, that's the repetition of the famous land, offspring, and blessing promises to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And in Exodus 32:13, it says, they shall inherit it. So that means it's an inheritance. It belongs to the Old Testament Jews as an inheritance. Verse 2 says, you shall take some of the first of all the produce, that you refers to every head of a family who carried in the first fruits in his shoulder in a little basket. The basket is actually mentioned in a later verse. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say the basket, if the person was poor, if the offeror was poor, the basket consisted of peeled willow branches or consisted of palm leaves. If the offeror was rich, the basket was silver or gold. Now, this first of all the produce, the NIV Study Bible and John Gill says that these first fruits are not to be confused with the annual offerings of the first fruits, which we've already talked about, the barley harvest, Nisan 16th, second day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. That was the first fruits of the barley harvest. And then, of course, you got the first fruits of the wheat at the Feast of Weeks. And there was that's also called the Feast of First Fruits sometimes. And these are well set out. We've already discussed these in previous sections of the law. And so this, according to NIV Study Bible and John Gill, is something different. Well, I don't know about that, because I found several commentators who made no difference. In fact, none of the commentators I consulted separated the first fruits here from the normal annual first fruits at the barley harvest and the wheat harvest. This is what Benson, the commentator, says, quote, this seems to have been especially enjoined to each master of a family, and the time when these first fruits were to be presented was the Feast of Pentecost, that would be the Feast of Weeks, in the early summer, late spring, when, as well as at the two other great feasts, that of the Passover and that of Tabernacles. Now, note Benson adds the Feast of Tabernacles. There was no set annual first fruits festival at the Feast of Tabernacles, but he says, no, they brought them there too. So it's apparently very unclear exactly when the first fruits were offered. We know they were offered for the barley harvest and the wheat harvest as a set festival. As for when these first fruits are to be brought in, there's a difference of opinion. But whenever they were offered, it was a big deal. It's mentioned a lot in the law, Deuteronomy 18:4. You shall give him, God, the first fruits of your grain, your wine, your oil, and the first shearing of your sheep. Leviticus 23:10, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land which I am going to give you and reap its harvest. Then you shall bring in the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. Leviticus 2:14. Also, if you bring a grain offering of early ripened things to the Lord, you shall bring fresh heads of grain roasted in the fire, grits of new growth, for the grain offering of your early ripened things. Here is Numbers 28:26. This is a fixed festival, the Feast of Weeks, First Fruits Festival. Also, on the day of the first fruits, when you present a new grain offering to the Lord in your Feast of Weeks, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. So you see, first fruits is a big deal in the Old Testament. It's used many times in the New Testament, the most famous of which, I guess, is 1 Corinthians 15:20. But now Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who are asleep. And of course, the idea is kind of like a down payment. There are going to be some who are raised, and Christ is going to be one who is raised, and then there's going to be a whole ton of other people raised, those who believe in him. Now, what's the purpose of this ceremony of the first fruits? Well, Adam Clark says the ceremony was intended to keep them in continual remembrance of the kindness of God. John Gill says that the ceremony was to acknowledge God as the proprietor of the land, so the first fruits was a sort of a small rent for the land. All of this was to be done where? In the place, verse 2, the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name. And of course, that was Jerusalem. Why is this in the law? Because Moses wanted to centralize the Israelites' worship. He wanted to keep them from going off to the high hills and the groves to practice idolatry, and God wanted that too, of course. John Gill says the place was successively Mizpah, Shiloh, and especially Jerusalem. They took them a while to get to Jerusalem, but the ultimate place that God had chose for all of the sacrifices and the festivals and such was Jerusalem. It's interesting that in all the references to the central place, and there are many in the law, Moses never mentions its name, never mentions Jerusalem. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculates as to why, so the Canaanites wouldn't know where the Israelites were going and concentrate their forces there, figuring that maybe the Canaanites might get a copy of the law somehow. Another reason Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown speculates that God through Moses never mentions the place is because that the other tribes that weren't Judah and Benjamin, the other tribes in which Jerusalem did not lay, might become jealous of Judah and Benjamin if word had gotten out in advance where the place was going to be. We go now to Deuteronomy 26:3-4. You shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him, I declare this day to the Lord my God that I have entered the land which the Lord swore to our fathers to give us. Then the priest shall take the basket from your hand and set it down before the altar of the Lord your God. Now the priest is mentioned here. John Gill mentions that it might be the high priest. It's not the high priest. How could one high priest see all these family heads bringing in first fruits? Colin Delitch says it was an ordinary priest who was officiating. I think that's a no-brainer. So the offeror is to go to the priest and declare, I have entered the land this day. I have entered the land. Again, tying the festival of the ceremony of the first fruits with the possession of the promised land that was promised to the patriarchs. I've entered the land. Now this offeror declares to the Lord, a couple of ways you can read that. He could be declaring to the priest who stands in the place of the Lord, so that by speaking to the priest, he was speaking to the Lord. Or it could be he's just directly speaking to God, because we can always speak to God. So the priest shall take the basket of the first fruits, set it down on the altar, and John Gill points out that it was more than just setting it out. The priest traditionally waved it as a wave offering. Remember, a heave offering was the offering was lifted up and down, because you had to lift it, you had to heave it. A wave offering goes from side to side as you wave it. And again, some people dispute that, but I think that's a safe assumption as to what those two offerings are. We go now to Deuteronomy 26:5-10. You shall answer and say before the Lord your God. Let me just switch to God's word here. You will make this formal statement in the presence of the Lord your God. The reason I say that is because nobody asked him a question. Nobody's asked this offeror a question, and then the NASB says you shall answer. That has something to do with the language. It's the same thing in Greek translation problem. God's word translation puts it in our English. You will make this formal statement in the presence of the Lord and say before the Lord your God, my father was a wandering Aramean. Aramean, of course, is a Syrian. And he went down to Egypt and sojourned there. This is referring to Jacob, few in number, but there he became a great, mighty, and populous nation. And the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us and imposed hard labor on us. Then we cried to the Lord, the God of our fathers, and the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction and our toil and our oppression. And the Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and with great terror and with signs and wonders. And he has brought us to this place and has given us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Again, one more connection. They're supposed to recite this to the priest. And again, the basket of first fruits is connected with the land that is flowing with milk and honey, the land that's produced the first fruits. Now behold, I have brought the first of the produce of the ground, again referring to the land which you, O Lord, have given me, and you shall set it down before the Lord your God and worship before the Lord your God. Now let's look at verse 5. The offeror is to say, my father was a wandering Aramean. This is referring to Jacob. How did Jacob wander? Well, as the NIV Study Bible says, he wandered from southern Canaan to Haran. That was in order to get Rachel his wife. He went back from Haran back to southern Canaan. This is all in Genesis 27 and 35. And while he was down there, the famine hits and he migrates to Egypt. In Genesis 46, 3 through 7, he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt. This is God speaking to Jacob. For I will make you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will surely bring you up again, and Joseph will close your eyes. Jacob arose from Beersheba, etc., 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 and goes on down to Egypt. I won't read it, but that's what it's referring to. He's wandered all over the place, just like Abraham did, for that matter. The reason we know this is Jacob as the particular wandering patriarch is because it says he went down to Egypt and sojourned there. Of course, Abraham did there for a while when he got his wife taken into Pharaoh's harem, but all the commentators seem to say this is referring to Jacob, not Abraham. He went down to Egypt and sojourned there, few in number, but there became a great and mighty and populous nation. Now, of course, that's as they were under Joseph during the times of Joseph, and they multiplied until they became slaves. And so there's a little repetition of the history of Israel. The Old Testament loves to look back and remember when you were a slave in Egypt. And here's another example of it right here, where they are to remember by reciting this little formula. Now, this phrase, wandering Aramean, has an interesting history of translation. The Latin Vulgate has, my father was, it translates it this way, a Syrian persecuted my father. Not my father was a wandering Aramean, but a Syrian persecuted my father and he went down to Egypt. Well, that's okay. The Septuagint has, my father abandoned Syria, and thus went on down to Egypt. The Targum has, Laban the Syrian endeavored to destroy my father. The Syriac version has, my father was led out of Syria into Egypt. That's interesting, doesn't make any difference. What is the purpose of mentioning wandering here? My father was a wandering Jew. Why did God tell the Jews to recite that when they offered their first fruits? Well, it was to show that Israel was still wandering, just like her father Jacob, but the wandering is now over. They've crossed into the land. Again, we're tying the land to the first fruits. They couldn't do the first fruits while they're in the wilderness because they couldn't grow any crops, but now they've entered the land and the wandering is over. So it's kind of a, shall we say, an ironic reference to their forefathers wander, but now they're not going to be wandering anymore. Why was Jacob called a Syrian, by the way, or an Aramean? Aramea, of course, is just the old word for Syria. Well, it's because he married two Aramean women, Leah and Rachel. He lived in Aramea a long time trying to marry Rachel. I think it was about 14 years, if I remember correctly. And his mother, Rebekah, was also from Aramea, from Haran in Syria. So that's why he's called a wandering Aramean. We go down to Deuteronomy 26, verse 11. And you, that's the offeror, and the Levite and the alien who's among you, shall rejoice in all the good which the Lord your God has given you in your household. Now, why are the Levite and alien mentioned along with the offeror here? Well, this is why. The basket of first fruits was presented to the Lord. That meant the priest got the basket, and then the priest shared the first fruits with the offeror, the Levite, and the alien, according to the pulpit commentary. And note that, once again, this is an example of where the law looks out for the alien. It's repeated over and over and over again in the law. You shall look out for the alien. Perhaps another basket full of ordinary Israelites and Levites and the aliens was presented. In other words, John Gill says that there might have been two baskets. You give one to the priest and then another basket is broken out for the non-priest and the Levites and the aliens. I don't think so. Let's just keep it simple. Priest got the basket, and he shared out of the basket with the Levites and the aliens. Again, Levites are mentioned a lot as well as the aliens because Levites didn't have land to grow their own crops. They were dependent upon tithes. And if the people didn't give the tithes, the Levites didn't eat. Notice that there is rejoicing. You shall rejoice in all the good which the Lord has given you. The pulpit commentary says a festive meal was to consummate the ceremony of the first fruits. The priest would take the basket and share with the offerer, Levite and the alien. Then they would sit down and have a feast. And what happens at a feast? You rejoice. And, of course, this illustrates that when you give of your first fruits, it's a joyful thing. It's not a tax. It's a joyful thing, a voluntary thing. Well, this is actually not voluntary. This is required. But it's still supposed to be done joyfully. The Lord loves a cheerful giver. There were other occasions in which all these three categories of people rejoiced with each other, the ordinary Israelite, the offerer, and the Levite and the alien. For example, in Deuteronomy 12:7, there also you and your household shall eat before the Lord your God and rejoice in all your undertakings in which the Lord your God has blessed you. This is referring to freewill offerings, which of course were peace offerings, which were jointly the sacrifices of which were jointly participated in by the priest and the people and the Levites. Deuteronomy 16:10-15. Then you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks. Now, this passage I'm going to read you here refers to the annual fixed feast of the first fruits, which might be different than the ordinary first fruits, or, you know, there's a difference of opinion on that. But my point here is the happiness that goes along with the meals that are associated with these festivals of first fruits. First, we'll start with the Feast of Weeks. That's the Feast of Harvest, Pentecost, Sivan the Sixth. Late spring, early June, late May, early June. Then you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks to the Lord your God with a tribute of a freewill offering of your hand, which you shall give just as the Lord your God blesses you, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God. Rejoice before the Lord your God, you and your son and your daughter, and your male and female servants, and the Levite, and the stranger and the orphan, Verse 13, you shall celebrate the Feast of Booths. That was the Feast of Weeks. Now let's look at the Feast of Booths, which is in Tishri 15. In autumn, September/October, you shall celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days, and you shall rejoice in your feast. And then down in verse 15, talking about the Feast of Booths, you will be altogether joyful. So the point is God's so-called taxes, if you want to look at them that way, his forced contributions, were to be associated with joy. Now, we're finished with first fruits, so let's go to tithing in Deuteronomy 26:12-13. When you have finished paying all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing, then you shall give it to the Levite, to the stranger, to the orphan, and to the widow, that they may eat in your towns and be satisfied. You shall say before the Lord your God, I have removed the sacred portion from my house, and also have given it to the Levite and the alien, the orphan, and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed or forgotten any of your commandments. Now we're going to start talking about the law of the tithe, and I just did a cursory examination once again of tithing on the internet. There are so many opinions. They all contradict each other. The law is not clear. Some people very apodictically say, this is what it is. And then others say, well, we just don't know and I don't care. Well, as a practical matter, we're not under the law of the tithe anymore in the Old Testament. We're under the New Covenant law of Christ, and that law says God loves a cheerful giver. That's it. There's no commands about do you tithe on the gross, do you tithe on the net? What about the second tithe? Some of the tithe goes to the church, and then extra tithe goes to the missionary and the parachurch organizations, and all this absolute, utter nonsense that the Church of Jesus Christ has layered on the New Testament Christian, basically putting us back under the Mosaic law, which nobody can understand, nobody can explain it exactly how the tithing system worked. And so you got something that's very fuzzy. And then when when the book of Hebrews says over and over again, you're not under the law, then these preachers and these teachers put us back under the law again. So you got to follow the Old Testament law of the tithe. Now what it is, I'm not really sure. Anyway, it's one of my pet peeves. I remember one time I was doing a teaching on this, and there was a brother in the audience who agreed with me basically on, he didn't call himself that, but he was basically a New Covenant theology guy. He realized that there was a distinction between the Old and the New Covenant. And I was talking about how the law of the Sabbath doesn't apply and anymore for the New Testament Christian. And I got to the tithe, and he looked like he was going to choke and die right on the spot. And he actually verbally objected to what I said. And I'm thinking, well, my friend, why are you latching on to the tithe as something that ought to be carried over? It's because it's about money, folks. And let's face it, the church system lives on money. Well, you say, but the Bible has all kind of things about supporting itinerant ministers, for example, and elders. I agree with that. But it ain't with a tithe. It's by voluntary giving. The Lord loves a cheerful giver. The Bible also has a lot to talk about supporting the poor, the widow, and the orphan. But it's not by tithes. It's by voluntary giving. So let's begin here in Deuteronomy 26, verse 12. We see this is the third year tithe. Now, first of all, let's distinguish the thirds here. We got a third tithe in the third year. There's two different thirds, the third tithe and the third year. The first tithe is the tithe given by all the Israelites to the priest and the Levites. And the Levites got their offering from that. And then the Levites tithe from their portion, the 90% that was left. They took a tithe of that and gave it to the priest. And from the Levites to the priest tithes was the second tithe. And this tithe right here, which is also called the poor tithe, is the third tithe. Now, as far as eating with the tithe, some people say the first tithe, there was a big festival when the Levites got their first tithe. Some people say it's when the Levites gave it to the priest. I don't know. But now this is a third tithe. Now, we still have a problem because some people say the third tithe is the same thing as the second tithe. In other words, the second tithe was given to the priest, and then it was also shared with the Levite, the stranger, the orphan, the widow. The only difference is that on the third year, instead of being the festival, the feast, being eaten in Jerusalem, it was eaten out in the local towns. The other view is this third tithe, and this tithe in the third year was actually a third tithe. It was not the same as the second tithe, just eaten in a different place. It was actually a different tithe. It was only exacted every third year, and it was a special tithe for everybody to eat with the poor. Now, which way it is, I don't know. I don't care. And by the way, there's also controversy on what does third year mean. Does it mean the third year after the Jubilee year? In which case you would only have one, every 7 years you would only have one poor tithe eaten in Jerusalem. Again, that depends on if you believe there is such a thing as a third tithe or whether it's the second slash third tithe eaten in a different place. So every 3 years after the year, after the seventh year, Sabbath year, they would move from Jerusalem to the towns, according to one view. So you see, the permutations and combinations on tithing in the Old Testament are enough to where somebody could get 3 or 4 PhD dissertations out of it, and I'm not going to go into any further detail on that. I just will say, to get away from the trees and look at the forest, the idea was everybody's taken care of, the priests, the Levites, the poor, the alien. They were dependent upon the ordinary working Israelites. Verse 13 says that you shall say before the Lord your God. A lot of times that means before the priest, but it can't mean the priest here because they're eating the third tithe out in your towns, out in the remote towns. So that would just be before God personally without an intermediary. We go now to verses 14 and 15. I have not eaten of it while mourning. This again is what the offeror is supposed to say before the Lord his God. He's supposed to affirm that I have not eaten of it while mourning, nor have I removed any of it while I was unclean, nor offered any of it to the dead. I have listened to the voice of the Lord my God. I have done according to all that you have commanded me. Look down from your holy habitation from heaven and bless your people Israel and the ground which you have given us, a land flowing with milk and honey, as you swore to our fathers. Now, notice verse 14, I have not eaten of it while mourning. Remember, I just finished saying how these first fruit festivals were all accompanied with rejoicing joy. So obviously, if you're mourning for a loved one who's died or for whatever reason, no, you don't eat the first fruit festival then, because this was supposed to be a time of joy. No, has I removed any of it? That means given any of it to the priest while he was unclean. Obviously, you wouldn't want to do that. That's a no-brainer. Nor has the offerer offered any of it to the dead. Now, what does that mean? John Gill suggests that there were funeral feasts made at the burial of the dead. And so what he's saying is, I haven't taken any of my first fruits and given it at these funeral feasts. I've given it to you, God, not to a funeral feast, and that would probably sounds like a pagan funeral feast. John Gill and Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown all suggest that they were feasts given in honor of dead men who were deified, in which case that the feast at a deified dead man's celebration would be an idolatrous feast, idolatry. And so the guy's saying, I didn't do anything idolatrous. No funeral feast. No feast in honor of dead men. Didn't do that. Verse 15, the offeror says to God, look down from your holy habitation. Isaiah 57:15 says this, for thus says the high and exalted one who lives forever. He's high and exalted. That's why he looks down on us. Who lives forever, whose name is holy. I dwell on a high and holy place. That's why we always say God is up. And also with the contrite and lowly of spirit, in order to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. Now notice one of the last things that the Israelite is supposed to say to God. The ground which you have given us, a land flowing with milk and honey, as you swore to our fathers. Once more, the connection of the land with the first fruits that the land produced. The land is the result of the covenant promises made to the patriarchs, and these Israelites are getting to enjoy the inheritance, the fulfillment of that promise, and it's a land flowing with milk and honey. So now we go to Deuteronomy 26, verses 16 through 19, and we'll finish up this chapter. This day the Lord your God commands you to do these statutes and ordinances. You shall therefore be careful to do them with all your heart and with all your soul. You have today declared the Lord to be your God, and that you would walk in his ways and keep his statutes, his commandments, and his ordinances, and listen to his voice. The Lord has today declared you to be his people, a treasured possession, as he promised you, and that you should keep all his commandments. Once again, that's Moses' theme. Here's the law, keep them. Keep the law, keep the law. He says it over and over again. And that he will set you high above all nations, Moses continues, which he has made for praise, fame, and honor, and that you shall be a consecrated people to the Lord your God as he has spoken. Notice that all nations have been made for praise, fame, and honor. No, that's not the way it reads. He will set you for praise, fame, and honor above all nations, that you shall be a consecrated people. Now, verse 16, it says, the day the Lord your God commands you to do these statutes. The Hebrew terminology is terminology that is found in ancient Near Eastern covenants or treaties, as the NIV Study Bible says. So this is a covenant that's being made or reaffirmed. It's actually the Sinai covenant that's being reaffirmed by Moses and the people on the plains of Moab. In fact, it says in verse 17, you have today declared the Lord to be your God. Well, when was that? Well, Matthew Poole says it refers to this day, i.e. at this time in the wilderness where you have accepted and ratified God's covenant. Well, more specifically, when in the wilderness? That could have been at Mount Sinai. Is it at Mount Sinai or is it on the plains of Moab 38 years later? The pulpit commentator says that it's now when Moses is delivering this discourse, and I think that's exactly what it is. Today you declare by listening to me and not objecting and crossing the Jordan River, you are getting ready to cross the Jordan River. You have declared that you are going to follow his commandments and statutes. It says in verse 18, the Lord has today declared you to be his people again, because that's when Moses is delivering the speech. Today declared you. The people are called a treasured possession. Exodus 19:5 says, now then, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, notice the condition, then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. Of course, the Israelites didn't obey his voice, and they got transported out by the Assyrians and the Babylonians, but if they'd have just obeyed, they would have been God's treasured possession. Now, of course, this is a type of the New Testament, antitype the Church of Jesus Christ, which is also a treasured possession. Ladies and gentlemen, we have finished Deuteronomy chapter 26. Next chapter is Deuteronomy 27, verses 1 through 26, and we will look at the curses which will be hurled from Mount Ebal to the north of Shechem. Hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.